The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So many goals, 7 for Liverpool as they slice through Roy's boys at Selhurst Park. Game of the weekend involves Leeds again. Another feather in the cap for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the hipster manager killer. Arise Sajourier, back to doing what he does best, giving away absolutely needless penalties as Leicester win at Spurs. Arsenal's crisis deepens and Matt Ritchie scores an absolutely world-class own goal. Another Watford manager gets fired, Celtic win last year's Scottish Cup, and the secrets behind the top 100 players in the world this year. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Flo Lloyd-Hughes, hello.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Jonathan Liu, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Paul says, is it still a crazy, unpredictable season where anyone can beat anyone if Liverpool have the title wrapped up before January? Crystal Palace 0, Liverpool 7. Johnny, they're going to win the league, aren't they?
Well, I think they will, but I don't think they've got the title sewn up or anything. They're sort of 4 points clear. And I mean, by this stage last season, yes, they had the title wrapped up. They were, you know, about 30 points clear and whatever. And it was kind of looking like a bit of a farcical league. But, you know, Leicester are 4 behind them. United, I think, are 5 with the game in hand. Manchester City, I guess, are the big unknowns here. They're sort of, you know, 8 back and you know, just beginning to put a run together. So, I mean, mathematically, I think there are still plenty of teams in the title race. And the fact that Liverpool have had all these injuries and still kind of look so ominously good, you could take that, you know, one of two ways. You could say, well, if this is kind of you know, Liverpool's B game, then once they find their A game, they're going to be, you know, pretty unstoppable. Alternatively, you could say that the efforts they're putting in now might well end up they might end up paying for them later in the season, because they are stretching themselves so thinly right now that, you know, whether they'll be able to sustain that intensity over you know, 38 games with a squad that as depleted as this. So there are lots of unknown. I suppose the answer is I don't know, and nor does anyone.
Do you know, Flo?
I have no idea, but I completely agree with everything that Jonathan said. I think
you can have a really easy podcast if
I'll just nod along. I think what's far more sort of predictable is who's going to get relegated. That gap is, it is looking pretty bleak for those at the bottom. And I think it's just now the only exciting bit that's left is out of Burnley and Fulham, who's going to go down. Can't wait to watch that unfold over the next few months. But I think there's still a lot to fight for at the top.
Barry, there were 7 goals. Which was your favourite for Liverpool?
My favourite was Roberto Firmino's first one, I think.
Yes, Liverpool's third.
Yes, Liverpool's third, Robert Firmino's first. Just the touch and the finish were beautiful. I love his beaming smile.
Paid for in Turkey, don't forget that. Bro, you could have that smile too if you wanted to go on that trip.
I may have to get one, because his smile is certainly more pleasant than mine after years of smoking fags. But, with regard to the question, have Liverpool the title sewn up? We've seen how much things can change very quickly. Not so long ago, Tottenham were being touted as possible title winners, and that's gone pear-shaped very quickly for them. See also Frank Lampard's Chelsea. But I think they are undoubtedly the best team in the division. A lot of nice goals to choose from in this game, but Firmino first was the pick of them for me.
Yeah, the composure in the finish, a total delight. And he started the move as well. I can only now picture Barry walking into the office with gleaming white teeth.
Gleaming white straight teeth, because my front teeth are crooked from an injury I got in my first ever rugby match. And my mother, I hadn't got a gum shield, and my mother didn't want me to play because I hadn't got a gum shield. So my dad went, he'll be fine. And about 10 minutes in, I got an elbow in the face, and my teeth have been crooked ever since. So, and my mother has never forgiven my father for that. But Anyway.
Was he playing against you? That's an interesting game, isn't it?
No.
Fathers v young children rugby match. That's the Irish upbringing.
No, he just dropped me down to play and thought, what are the chances of anything bad
happening? I mean, I don't think Turkey are on the travel ban list, Barry. So if you haven't got any plans over Christmas, why don't you pop over?
I could. I don't have any plans. I have nothing better to do. And then I could arrive back in January with
what a
gleaming set of Delph.
For the January transfer window. Just
and I would obviously expect none of you to comment on this transformation.
Why does Barry look like Brendan Rodgers? This is very strange. I think Mo Salah did an interview with Ass, Johnny, and where he sort of talked about his future in sort of pretty unspectacular ways. Some speculation is that's why he didn't start the game, because he doesn't really talk to the press ever. I think he basically just said, I think Barcelona and Real Madrid are quite good football teams. I'm not reading any more into that. What are you reading into it? And I wonder if Flo will agree with what you said after you've said it.
I read into it precisely what I think, most rational thinking people would read into it, which I guess is not the same as what, the rapacious shit beast of the media would like to read into it. As a member of the media myself, you know, great colleagues, great time. Generally speaking, is there an answer that Mo Salah could have given to a question about his future which would not set off feverish transfer speculation? If he just says no comment, Salah remains tight-lipped on potential transfer link. It's flattering to me. Salah flattered by transfer links. This is a kind of the game that we play. Whether it's the right thing for him to move on, or whether he wants a new challenge in his career, is a question really for Salah and his representatives. I'd be sad as a watcher of Premier League football to see him go, and I don't think he'll go.
Maybe they would have to just complete non sequiturs should be what footballers do. So he's asked the question and he just gives you like the recipe for a beef stroganoff, and there's
right.
Yeah, there's
the,
no
the
way
the city
you can,
is full of sinners.
that would be like Salah in City sinning slur storm, wouldn't it? So you know, don't want to do that.
I'm not sure why he would want to move unless it's for more money or he's angling for a juicier contract, because at Liverpool he has everything pretty much a successful, ambitious footballer would want. He's winning things, he's a regular in the first team, he's scoring lots of goals, he's got a manager who obviously has huge appreciation for him and fans who absolutely adore him. I'm not sure what the next level is.
You're just describing your own life there, Barry, aren't you?
Pretty much.
What is there's no next level. Flo, how much did you enjoy, and I suppose it's a sign of elite sports people wanting to win and wanting to be the best, Sadio Mane being very angry to be taken off when I think Liverpool were 4-0 up, cruising along.
Yeah, and I think he's done that a couple of times, and it's great. I mean, his goal on the weekend as well was fantastic, and it must be great for Klopp to have someone like that in the team who wants to be able to get a hat-trick in most games. And I think it was funny the way Match of the Day highlighted the comparison of Firmino's reaction when his pearly whites were gleaming because he got to rest for an extra 20 minutes, whereas Mane was stone-faced. It's great that and he did that, and also what he did with that video that was doing the rounds on Twitter, the Anfield rap shared and the club shared, was a lovely gesture. And he just seems like such a nice guy, and to have that person around the club, I mean, it's the dream.
Right, Manchester United 6, Leeds 2. Leeds games are the best, Barry, aren't they?
Yes, Leeds games are the best, and the post-match reaction to Leeds games is also the best. I mean, Leeds, let's not beat around the bush, got an absolute spanking yesterday. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took on Marcelo Bielsa at his own game and gave him a good hiding, and he's getting praise he deserves for doing that. And people, there seems to be a Bielsa backlash now. But Manchester United have a squad worth £700 million. The Leeds starting 11 yesterday was assembled and acquired from Lorient, Brentford, Bristol City, Chesterfield, Lugano, the Leeds Academy, Rennes, Valencia, FC 20, Aloni from Man City, and Middlesbrough. And the three subs they brought on, one was from their own academy, one was from the Ajax Academy, and one was from the Morecambe Academy. So Manchester United should routinely be swatting aside teams like that. I don't think that's too controversial a thing to say. So people who have been saying that Bielsa has been overpraised for what he's done with Leeds are now overpraising Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for beating this, you know, team that you could argue doesn't really have any business being in the Premier League in the first place. So I think it's fair to say you've two managers there who are both doing a pretty good job. There's room for improvement with both of them. And, you know, one of them definitively doesn't have to be better than the other. But Bielsa is definitively better manager than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah, we got lots of messages, Johnny, about this. I can't remember who wrote it, so apologies, just saying, is Bielsa just Kevin Keegan with a bucket?
I saw that.
And you wrote a piece about, basically, along the similar lines of what Barry just said. I imagine he just read your piece and has just read it to you.
I haven't read his piece, actually.
Fair enough. Johnny?
Well, I mean, yeah, they got spanked 6-2. I mean, one of the great things about football is that the scoreline is both, you know, you can't argue with a scoreline. That happened, and Leeds got spanked. And yet it's such a snapshot of, you know, this 90-minute period that is then taken as, you know, inviolable evidence of, you know, this team's inherent morality or this team's inherent foolishness. And you know, it was just a game of football where Leeds basically just weren't there for about 3 or 4 minutes, and Scott McTominay could have snuck in like Romario. And you know, so if that doesn't happen, maybe it's a totally different game. I think what Bielsa would say through a translator is that if you play that game, you know, 100 times with that same approach, how many times is it going to end up 6-2? And this idea that he needs to kind of modify the principles that he's carried through him in football for 30, 35 years because they lost 2 goals to Scott McTominay in the first 3 minutes, I find kind of risible. Taking an even broader view here, I think there is obviously, you know, the praise that Bielsa gets, the adulation, the sort of the slightly weird fanboyishness. You know, people do kind of react against that. But would people prefer it if they just kind of shut up shop like a Burnley or a Sheffield United and play for a 1-0 or a 2-0? I don't really understand that. The whole idea of football is that it has textures, that teams play in different ways, and that occasionally you get this totally mad genius who comes along and decides to attack, you know, Manchester United with 6 or 7 players, even though they're 6-2 down. I think there's a, you know, call it romance or whatever you want. That's part of what makes football entertaining to me. And I'm sure it makes, you know, football very entertaining to Leeds fans as well while they were coming through the championship. So, yeah, they lost 6-2.
The reaction, Barry, as you said, it is funny. And I just wonder if it's because we are, you know, part of the sort of football hipster beacons that we are obviously going to praise Bielsa to the hilt. And then the people that don't like... So it also becomes not about Bielsa. He's just the pawn in between the football hipsters and the football dinosaurs having their weekly row about something.
I'm sure he couldn't give a shit if he is aware of his position there. But the thing is, Leeds adopted the same approach against Liverpool and Man City and did okay with it. So I like watching them play. I make no apologies for that. You're guaranteed entertainment. They are obviously going to ship awful hiding sometimes playing like that. And as far as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is concerned, you've people going, oh, well, Manchester, everyone's been calling for his head, and yet Manchester United would go second if they win their game in hand. And that is absolutely fair. But you also have to legislate for the fact that Manchester City, Arsenal, and to a lesser extent Chelsea are all having poor seasons. They're, and even if Manchester United are second. The game against Crystal Palace still happened. The fact remains that they were incredibly lucky to beat Brighton in the second game of the season. They got off to a bad start. They still lost that game in Turkey in the Champions League against a team who had no business beating them. So, yes, he deserves praise when things are going well, but you can't just sweep the rest of it under the carpet.
Here's a question from me. I suppose I ask some of them. But given that Leeds games are great, whether they win or lose, and Spurs games are generally quite boring, whether they win or lose, what happens when Leeds play Spurs, Barry?
I think that would be a very entertaining game, to be honest. It was just two markedly different contrasts in style. But I wonder now if other managers will see what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, how he set up his team yesterday. And again, he deserves praise for that. Will they do the same? And if so, how will it work? How will Bielsa attempt to counter it? I don't know. I suggest he won't do much, but...
Can you explain what Solskjaer did that was good?
Well, he... Leeds, the way they go about their business is they mark man for man and tear into teams straight from the first whistle. And Manchester United did that exact same thing yesterday and... but sort of overwhelm them straight from the whistle. They also used Bruno Fernandes very cleverly, I think, because Calvin Phillips was given the job of man-marking him. So Bruno Fernandes was sort of a decoy in the Manchester United team, dragging Calvin Phillips out of position constantly, which left an enormous hole in the centre of the pitch, which the rest of Manchester United's attackers were able to exploit at will. And that's how they were able to sort of pour forward and create so many chances, which is generally what you expect Leeds to do. But so I think Leeds were out Leeds yesterday. Now, to be fair, three of their back four were playing out of position as well. I still think they would have got a gubbing, but because it was in midfield, they were overrun. But that is also worth bearing in mind. One other thing Solskjaer did is he started Dan James and used his speed to hurt Leeds, and also Scott McTominay, his speed was used to great advantage to hurt Leeds.
Yeah, I never knew Scott McTominay had speed or goal scoring ability like that. The first player in Premier League history to score twice in the first 3 minutes of a match. Spurs nil, Leicester 2 then. Leicester up to second. Alan asks, Johnny, were Spurs the best team?
Spurs are always the best team when Jose's in charge. Spurs have never not been the best team. I thought it was kind of interesting that they were all right for 40 minutes, and you know they had pretty decent chances in the second half as well. Son probably should have pulled one back or equalised. I think it was before the Alderweireld own goal, and Schmeichel made a great flying save. What I found interesting about that game was how well Leicester kind of stuck to their game plan, and how well Leicester adapted to try and stop Spurs breaking. They always had they had a three-man defence, and they had I think it was Ndidi and Tielemans sitting in front of them, and they cut off Spurs' counter-attack, which as we now know is basically the way they're going to score 80 or 90% of their goals. And the interesting thing was when Spurs had to chase the game in the second half, it wasn't quite, they weren't quite used to doing it because they are so well drilled, and they're honed into that sort of counter-attacking style, that the press wasn't quite there, and so they got done on the counter for the second goal, and obviously Maddison had a goal disallowed for offside. They couldn't find a way back into the game. So whether they're better side, no. I find it kind of risible that Mourinho sort of blamed the negative hangover from their Liverpool game for how they played here. For a guy who essentially bases his entire ethos on getting results, he's not getting the results, and he should probably own that.
Serge Aurier, arise. Flo, I don't know what to do. I don't know what I would do if I was a manager or if I was a teammate of Serge Aurier. He's actually had a really good season. He's kept Doherty out of the team. But what on earth, what is he doing? I don't expect you to have an answer.
Yeah, it was very stupid, and even more stupid in the age of VAR where things like that are going to be spotted. Back in the day, in the pre-VAR days, in VAR BC or B whatever VAR, you might be able to get away with that, and people have on lots of occasions. But when you're so clearly in the replay not looking at the ball whatsoever and just bashing out the man, you're not going to have much of a chance. And I think Spurs got away with a second penalty as well. Sissoko could have conceded another penalty. I thought that was a penalty, but not. It wasn't as clear as the Aurier one. And I think a lot of people afterwards, a lot of Spurs fans especially on Twitter, were saying they are quite worried about the Bale situation, because he's being the super sub that is being lent on too much, and he hasn't got going, it hasn't worked out, and Mourinho's just looking to him every time to try and kickstart and energise the game, and that sub ended up not really doing much. And when you're leaning on someone who has re-arrived or returned with so much fanfare, and across the bench, you haven't really got much else. I mean, Bergwijn didn't start, and Moura is someone who they look to a lot to come off the bench as well. And neither Bale nor Moura offer much to really change things for Spurs when they are losing.
It's interesting that Bale is 2 years younger than Vardy. And like Vardy looks, obviously, humans are different, aren't they? Their bodies are different. And Vardy looks so sharp and so on it and such a nightmare to play against. And Bale looks, I mean, we knew he wasn't the Gareth Bale that was at Spurs 7 years ago, but you know, but he doesn't look like he's doing much, Barry.
Well, I think that's probably down to the way in which Jamie Vardy takes care of himself, you know, with his Skittles and vodka diet.
Eight Red Bulls
a day. God almighty. I just shudder to think what I'd be like after 8 Red Bulls. But anyway, yeah, I mean, Vardy just doesn't seem to be showing any sign of slowing down whatsoever. Is it something to do with the fact that, compared to Bale, he grew up in the school of hard knocks? I honestly don't know. I'm just hypothesising. And is he hungrier? But Bale, let's face it, hasn't played much football for a very long time. So it is kind of understandable he's a bit ring rusty, but Jose clearly doesn't trust him yet to start games.
Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we will carry on discussing the existential crisis at the Emirates. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. To Goodison, then Everton 2, Arsenal 1. I always feel a bit like we should start with the team that wins over the team that loses, but the headline is really Arsenal, isn't it? This is their worst record at the start of the season since 1974-75. So I'm loath to talk about crises, but that's quite a long time ago. And I mean, are they in a relegation battle, Flo? Or is that a ridiculous thing to say?
I don't think they're in a relegation battle, but I think they're a bit of a crossroads internally and philosophically about what they want to do going forward, because there is a bit of a reality check that I think needs to happen, not only with the fan base, but I also think with the club itself about who they want to be. And it's a bit like, you know, when Ferguson left United, about who they want to be, what are they aiming for, the amount of money they want to spend, who's going to be the coach, what sort of football are they going to play. And the reality is that they employed a manager with no first team experience apart from once taking Man City when Pep wasn't there one game or something like that, and thrust him into one of the top jobs in English football, and the expectations were far too high. And I think last season he did well to shore them up defensively, and lots of people were singing his praises because up until that point under Emery, they'd been so leaky and all over the place. But at the same time, now it's the complete opposite. They just can't, the way that they're playing going forward is so stale. And I was there on Wednesday night for the Southampton game, and teams in completely different scenarios this season. But the way that Arsenal were playing, it's that way where a team is just sort of huffing and puffing and running around and not very much happens. Endlessly just trying to sort of chase the ball to the byline and then put in a terrible cross. And it was sort of more of that against Everton as well. And I think it's about, right, are we going to wait now with Arteta? Are we going to wait for him to grow alongside the team that he's coaching? Or are we going to start from scratch again, despite the money that we've spent? It's so difficult. And I think the better idea for me would be to be patient, would be to stick with Arteta, because they're not going to get relegated. There are so many bad teams in the Premier League this season. They're not going to get relegated. But if this is going to be a long-term project of patience, then there needs to be some kind of dialogue with the fans, because at the moment there isn't really that. And Edu's just coming out and saying, yeah, we believe in this project, it's great, when the reality is it's not great, because look at the way they're playing, look at the results. Arteta clearly needs help and support if it's going to be him.
Yeah, I think there was a certain, I mean, I don't want to say complacency, but I feel like that the way that Arteta tried to rebuild this team carried quite a lot of assumptions which have proven to be false. I think he felt like the way they ended last season with Aubameyang in the form he was, you know, you have Aubameyang, you have Lacazette, he brings in Willian, and you know, you have players like Saka coming through. And I think he felt like the goals would sort of take care of themselves a bit, because at Arsenal over the last 15, 20 years, the goals generally have taken care of themselves. And what we're seeing now is a problem that Arsenal haven't really had in for as long as I can remember watching them, really, that they don't know how to score goals. And not only that, we don't really know what an Arsenal goal looks like. We know what a Manchester City goal looks like, or a Liverpool goal, or even a Newcastle goal. You know, we have an idea of what that archetypal pattern of play is. But Arsenal just have, you know, they don't know what they're supposed to be doing anymore. And that I think is, you know, kind of touches on the sort of the existential problem that Flo was talking about. It's a crisis of identity, yes, but I mean, in the short term, it's also a crisis of these players are just not performing, and that was a problem which I think wasn't foreseen. So while he was trying to shore up, you know, the defence and you know, getting some muscle in midfield, they forgot how to score, and essentially that's at the root of what's going wrong now.
Meanwhile, Everton are up to fourth. The first team to do the London Grand Slam this season after beating Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, Fulham, West Ham and Crystal Palace. And it's interesting, the comparison with Arteta and Ancelotti, you know, they have a world-class manager with loads of experience, and it seems to be working. I mean, they were really good, then they lost a few, now they've won a few, and I suppose, I don't know, I always think they'll end up seventh. But Barry, would you give them any advance on that?
Yeah, absolutely. They are still capable of losing games when you don't expect them to. But as I recall, did Ancelotti and Arteta sort of get their jobs around about the same time? And people
yes.
were saying perhaps each should have got the other job. And I think if that had happened, I don't think Everton would be in the mess Arsenal are in, but I do think Arsenal would be doing an awful lot better. But that Everton side was missing arguably four of their best players, James, Luca Dean, Allen and Andre Gomez, and they still beat Arsenal. Didn't have to beat much, it must be said. But yeah, I think Manchester City have been so unconvincing. I remain unconvinced by Manchester United. Chelsea are having a wobble, so I can see no reason why they're certainly good enough to finish in the top four. Whether or not they can do that remains to be seen.
Yerry Mina's last four Premier League goals have all been scored in the 45th minute. This is only the second time in Premier League history a player has scored four goals in a row, all in the same minute. Can you guess the player and the minute? If you do, I'll give you a sweet.
Dzeko, 90.
Okay, half right. The 90th minute is correct. And that's the best. That would be the best minute guess. So that's, you know, we know that Johnny Lou's clever. He was good at countdown. So understandably, he gets the minute. But you're wrong with Dzeko.
Why don't you put the player's name in an anagram or a conundrum and then Johnny will be able to figure it out in 3 seconds?
Let me get a pencil.
Okay, here we go. I'll do that. It's in the chat function. The conundrum will start. Wait. Okay, have you all got a pen?
Wait.
Oh, God.
It's time for Can You Guess the Player?
Is this just last name or is it just last name?
The whole name.
It's the whole name.
Oh, man. We're out of time. Eric, somebody.
No, it's not Eric.
Craig.
No.
Something.
No, not Craig, but Chris someone.
Chris Eagles.
Chris Eagles, yes.
Oh!
Yeah. Well done, Johnny.
After about, you know, four and a half minutes.
Yeah. Adam says, why are coaches holding up the electronic board when subs are being made? I saw Big Dunk doing it for Everton yesterday. I now can't stop noticing that all clubs are doing it. Is it COVID? Overworked fourth officials? Coaching staff just looking for something to do? I don't know the answer to that. I mean,
it's the same reason we're all sitting at home and none of us get to see our family at Christmas, Max. So sorry, guys. Yeah, they bring their own boards with them as well. I'm pretty sure each club has a board.
Oh, right.
And then that means that they just look after their board. But for some reason, Duncan Ferguson doing it seems to get everyone really overexcited. Whereas, I don't know.
Ian Wohn doing it. It's just not the same,
yeah,
is it?
It's right, just not the same. It just doesn't hit the same way anymore.
Right, to St Mary's, Southampton 0, Man City 1. No side has conceded fewer goals or kept more clean sheets in the Premier League this season than Manchester City. This was a bit of a meh game, Barry, wasn't it? It could have been really, on paper, you thought, oh, this is a good one.
Yeah, it was meh. I thought I had high hopes for the game and it was two very good teams playing well within themselves and the team with the better players won quite unconvincingly. I don't really know what else to say about it beyond that.
I think that's quite a good review of it.
Okay, well, we leave it there then.
Yeah, absolutely. Although it's interesting, isn't it, Johnny, you mentioned City at the top and you sort of have a sneaking feeling that because nobody's talking about them at all, that they might actually do well this season, if that isn't counterintuitive.
Yeah, it feels like they've regrouped a little bit, and they in a season of limited teams, where nobody's really quite hit top gear, even Liverpool, quite yet. It's basically going to be about the team who can sort of quietly put six or seven wins together in a row. And is suddenly going to find themselves, in the mix. And City have kind of done that. I mean, I saw them at West Ham earlier this season, and they were, you know, kind of disjointed and you know, they weren't very fluent, and they weren't quite sure, you know, the things weren't quite gelling for them, and they drew 1-1. And now things, you know, they're not that fluent, and they're quite disjointed, and things aren't really working for them, but they're kind of churning out wins. And it could have been, they had sort of at least three or four like really good counter-attacking opportunities just in like the last five, six minutes. They could have put a real gloss on that scoreline. So, you know, I think they're banking on taking this season deep, that they will have the resources and they'll have the depth to challenge. And if it comes down to the last 10 games, they'll probably back themselves.
Big Sam back in the dugout, this time at West Brom. They lost 3-0 to Aston Villa. Sean says, is that the shortest new manager bounce ever? 1-0 after 5 minutes. What did you make of the game, Flo?
Villa were good. West Brom were very bad, and that's probably the situation for the rest of West Brom's season. And I think what is really tough for West Brom fans to take is this. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a massive West Brom fan, season ticket holder, and he was saying, we've worked so hard to battle the reputation and the shithousery that Pulis created with Bilic and that rock and roll football and being so entertaining and attractive last season, to then just go back to square one with Allardyce. And Allardyce has already come out and said how much he's going to change and, in my opinion, break these players. Some of which last season were some of the most exciting creative players in the whole division. And now he's basically just going to come and tell them to just boot it up at the first possible chance to Charlie Austin, who is patched together by every bit of bandage available in the Midlands. It's just so depressing, because I don't know what fans would rather, to be honest, when you come up from the Championship. Do you want to survive but be terrible, or do you want to go down and at least have a few nice games like the draw against Man City to talk about? I don't know.
Big Sam says he may strip Jake Livermore of the captaincy for that Street Fighter 2-esque challenge on Jack Grealish. I don't know what he was doing.
No, it wasn't a very clever challenge, and he deserved the red card. I think West Brom could possibly consider themselves lucky that Villa didn't have a man sent off as well. Stripping him of the captaincy within a week of arriving, I'm not sure what that... It seems a bit punitive, and I'm not sure what it would do for dressing room morale, which could possibly be already very low, but he's Big Sam. He could do what he wants.
Anyway, well done to Aston Villa. Good win for them. I really enjoyed Traore's finish as well. Side foot pass. No greater skill in football. Now, to the greatest moment of the weekend at St James's Park. Newcastle 1, Fulham 1. Matt Ritchie's face own goal, Barry.
It was terrific. I burst out laughing. Not because it happened to Newcastle player. I would have burst out laughing if it had happened to anyone, but it was incredibly funny. He seemed so oblivious to the fact the ball was coming his way. And like you said yesterday, it looked like he had time to do something about it, but just elected not to. Perhaps he was preoccupied by something he had to do after the game or whatever, pick up a suit from the dry cleaners or get some wine for dinner on the way home. On Match of the Day, they wondered how long it would be before he could laugh at it. I reckon this morning, probably, but they seem to think it wouldn't be till after he retires.
Callum Wilson, Flo, does he have every right to go down? Is that the phrase?
I wouldn't say he has every right. I would say this is what happens in football. If there's a slice, an inch, a fraction of contact, someone's going to go down. And unfortunately, the angle of which that happened, you completely understandable why the referee gave that penalty, because it was only when you really, 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 really break it down, you notice how smart Callum Wilson was being. Actually, on first look, you think, oh yeah, classic, easy penalty, easy decision. So it's one of them ones.
I mean, Graham Scott does have a chance to really, really break it down though, doesn't he? And he did, and then he went to the monitor and then he left the monitor. And I just couldn't help wondering if the VAR were like, no, 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 Graham, go back and look at the monitor. Like,
I feel like I think what's really difficult for them is they probably would want to sit there maybe for about 10 minutes to take a look at that one. And they probably just think, oh, I can't be asked. I'll add another 10 minutes onto my shift today, having to deal with these idiots. It looks like a penalty. I've had another look. People will be satisfied that I walked over to the monitor. Let's crack on with the game. Because actually, you do really have to sit there and have a proper look at it for more than 30 seconds. But he's got shit to do. He can't be doing that.
I'm not sure how that's how
it's
it works.
It's literally
but...
his job.
No, I do think, though, I would like to see, and maybe Jonathan can do this, someone who... I want to see a spreadsheet of the amount of minutes that the referee spends looking at the monitor, because No one spent longer than, what, 3 minutes?
I like
looking at that monitor.
Sorry, but I like the way you give Graham Scott a pass saying he's got shit to do, and you presume that Jonathan has nothing to do, that he can make a spreadsheet.
No, but, you know, people like Jonathan and writers at The Athletic will find a great angle on this. So I'm giving them that free present, that free offer to investigate. Why do referees spend so little time staring at the monitors? Because I'd love to know. Because actually, in reality, they could be there for ages and work it out and get the time and the production value that Match of the Day have. But they decide to just have a quick look. Looks like a penalty. Let's crack on.
Brighton won, Sheffield United won. And that was we don't talk about VAR when it's good. We talk about it when it's bad. So we talked about a lot for the Callum Wilson dive. We should say, look, it got the Livermore decision right. It got the Lundstrom decision right. I think
we forgot to mention it with the Maddison offside, but let's not go there.
No, you're right.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that, and I was not happy about that one. But I just can't believe we're still talking about the Premier League match. We've been talking about the Premier League for about 50 minutes. It's mad. We're still on Sheffield United Brighton. Will this discussion ever end? It was a game. It was 1-1. Good VAR. Brighton struggled to score goals. Sheffield United are going to get relegated. That's your analysis.
That'll do for part two. Part three, Marcus Christensen will join us, our football editor, to talk about the making of the top 100 players in the world this year. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's welcome our football editor, Marcus Christensen, who has collated the top 100 players, male players in the world this year, has released 100 through 71 today. Marcus, how are you?
Yes, good, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on. Bit disappointed you wouldn't let me put Wes Houlihan in my top 40, but I understand this is a serious business and you don't think I was taking it seriously enough. But just explain exactly how it's put together.
Yes, so we started in 2012 and then we had 11 judges on, including myself somehow. Nicky was on it, Sid, Paul Doyle and Jonathan Wilson, among others. But basically, you get sent a long list of about 300 people in the world who we think have done reasonably well in 2020. And it's important that it only takes this calendar year into account, so it's not a lifetime achievement award, which some judges struggled with, and therefore have Buffon as number one when he's played two games. But there's a system to deal with that as well. So a long list is sent out and every judge picks 40 players, and they then, if they're ranked number one, they get 40 points, and if they're ranked two, 39, and so down to number 40, who gets 1 point. The single biggest score is taken away from everyone, and you need at least 5 votes to get on the list, so you don't get biased voting from Sweden. Not that Swedes would do that, or any other country. So there are a few rules to the counting, but then they're all added up on the spreadsheet, as you will have seen this morning, that my colleague Steve McMillan handles, and he doesn't trust me to handle it, and rightly so, because one little mistake on there could ruin everything. So I don't want to go close to it. I am allowed to input some votes, but that's about it.
Now, people won't have noticed this, but 2020 has been a slightly strange year, hasn't it? Has that affected the voting?
Yes, I think so. I think because there was no major tournament, it normally has a big influence on who gets into the top 10. So obviously in 2018, we had Griezmann and N'Golo Kante and Mbappe in the top 10. And 2014, we had a lot of the Germany team like Müller and Philipp Lahm in the top 10. Obviously, we had no tournament this year. And then it's normally based on Champions League, Europa League, and the individual champions from the different teams.
Can you give us any... you can't give anything away. Can you tell us what number the highest English player is in the chart?
I think that is at number 17.
Number 17, interesting. And my other, how many Germans in the top 10?
There would be none, maybe.
None. Wow, that's interesting, isn't it? None. Barry, do you have any, you look like you're about to ask a question, Barry. I'm thrown by that no Germans.
Oh, I'm just having my. I'm not one for reading the comments section these days, but this one is always a treat for people getting very outraged because they don't understand that it's just for the calendar year. So what I'd like to ask you, Marcus, is how on earth can Dominic Calvert-Lewin be ranked higher than Eden Hazard, Ederson and Antoine Griezmann?
That's the kind of anger we want in this this part of the year as well, coming up to the festive season. Yeah, I mean, there are times I think you will always get some players that I personally think are higher than they should be, but enough people have voted for them. And if you look at just 2020 and the goals Calvert-Lewin has scored compared to the goals Eden Hazard has scored, for example, football is not always goals, but I think you'll find that Dominic Calvert-Lewin is ahead.
I don't think I put Calvert-Lewin in. Johnny, is that your fault?
No, I didn't have him anywhere near this. I was looking more at the first half of the year. I mean, the end of last season, because that's when the stuff was won and the big players did the important things. I placed less emphasis on what's happened in the start of this season.
Is number one surprising, Marcus? I mean, when do we find number one at?
On Christmas Eve. So we release 30 players a day, and then the top 10 on Christmas Eve. I think you find the usual suspects in the top 10, and we've got a deserving winner.
Does their name rhyme with Bionel Jesse?
I can say it's not Philippe Coutinho.
And do you enjoy doing that? Because it's quite an effort, A, just to chase people up who don't reply to the email, right? Is it a labour of love, or do you just think, why have I decided to do this again?
It's a bit of both, I have to say. When I open up the spreadsheet and saw last year's, a cold shiver went down my spine. Honestly, I felt slightly sick. And at that moment, I regret it. And then Steve and I normally have this part where it goes quite well. We count the votes, we're getting there. And then at the end, I always add it. 2 or 3, 4 or 5 or 6 late ones, and he gets fed up and he says, they haven't met the deadline, why should they be on there? And I say, they're doing it for free, and so on. And we have this small falling out, and then it takes 2 or 3 days, we make up, and then when you see it published, it's definitely worth it. I mean, it's a bit of fun, most of all, but I am pleased that we have so many judges from different countries and so on. I still want to get more from Spain and France and Germany and the other big leagues, because it is a bit Premier League heavy at times, but also I find a lot of the overseas just vote for Premier League players, probably because it's shown everywhere and it's probably the most watched league in the world when you get down below the top 4, 5 and so on. A lot of people will watch Aston Villa, whereas they might not watch Celta Vigo or something, or Genoa in Italy. So I'm still struggling a bit with the balance and want more judges from the rest of Europe. But I think it's a good list this year, and lots of good judges, including Cesc Fabregas, who the people at Get French Football News got for us. So it's nice to see.
Does his votes count more than my votes, as they probably should?
Absolutely not.
Oh, dear.
That would be unfair. what does he know about football?
Has anyone ever voted for themselves?
No, not yet. And I guess it's normally former players that are on the voting panel. And I think Fabregas is probably the closest we have got to someone who could vote for themselves.
Has anyone not made the cut this year that surprised you? Anyone out of the top 100?
I do always like to look underneath the top 100. And as we were discussing before, Koke is there, Gabriel Barbosa, Varane, De Gea, Kulusevski, the young Swedish Juventus player, Phil Foden, Pogba, Milinkovic-Savic, Angelino, Lloris, Adama Traore and Saul, and so on. So there's obviously a lot of players down there who maybe haven't had the best of season. It is good. I mean, I don't think Pogba should be on the list this year. And so that is good.
Yeah, but come on. Calvert-Lewin, I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Anyway. Marcus, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the pod.
And of course, Thanks very much, mate. And of course, you can get, yeah, they'll all be announced online each day, or even better, buy the newspaper and read it and read all the lists. Cheers, Marcus.
Cheers.
Marcus Christensen there, football editor. Well done to Celtic, who won the 2019-20 Scottish Cup final yesterday, beating Hearts on penalties. It was quite fun, Barry, this game, wasn't it?
Yeah, Celtic looked home and hosed, 2-0 up, and then Hearts took them to extra time. Both teams scored in extra time, and Celtic won on penalties to secure a historic quadruple treble. And so that's last season's tournament. I'm not sure if Celtic fans, who are currently very unimpressed with Neil Lennon, were able to suspend their ill feeling and go back to last season when they were quite happy with him. But an opportunity missed for Hearts and a historic achievement for Celtic and a very entertaining game.
Yeah, just to add to what Barry said, I think there were so many interesting storylines that came out of this. The Lennon situation being one of them, protests that had been at Celtic Park and the board giving their ominous support to him. They have gone on a three-game winning streak, but also Celtic goalkeeper Conor Hazard, no relation to the other Hazard family. 22 from Northern Ireland. He was the third choice Celtic keeper last season. Didn't actually have a great game, but somehow managed to be the hero in the penalty shootout and win it. And this is against a Hearts team who were relegated last season after the Premiership came to an end. So there's a lot of bad blood there. Hearts are walking the Championship, so they should be back in the top tier soon. But yeah, just a really interesting game. And there was a bit of a scuffle afterwards from Scott Brown. So it just had all the tick boxes of a cup final, just no fans, unfortunately.
Right, Watford have sacked Vladimir Ivic after 4 months in the role. So that's quite a good stint for a Watford manager, isn't it? They're fifth in the table, 4 points off second place. They've confirmed the appointment of Zisko Munoz, who was most recently manager of Dynamo Tbilisi. Flo, I mean, you follow the AFL in great detail. It's no surprise when Watford sack a manager.
Yeah, it's a funny one because I think a lot of people were surprised, not because they're Watford, because that's what they do, but because of their position in the table. They're in fifth. Obviously, you were working with Troy Deeney this morning. And I think when you dig deeper, there are a lot of issues there. And I saw a fantastic spreadsheet that a Watford fan had put together. I can't remember his name and I wish I'd kind of screenshotted it. But he did a spreadsheet which was a breakdown of every single game and the number of minutes that Watford were good in that game and the result. And it was sort of like 1-1, good for 10 minutes, poor rest, or like 2-1 win, good between 65 and 85. And I think there has been a lot at Watford that's been quite stale, and considering like Norwich, like Bournemouth, they've kept a lot of good players who played in the Premier League, they should really be putting in really good consistent performances and be in the top two, top three. And I think that's what the issue was. Yes, there's some leftover indecisiveness from the ownership, but I do think a lot of fans were quite worried about where this season was going, and the idea of them not going up or even making it to the playoffs was not going to happen.
Might I suggest, Flo, if you're looking for someone to put the spreadsheet together of minutes referees have spent looking at the monitor, the man who's made a spreadsheet of when Watford were good each minute has decided when they're good, that might be the place to go. Do you see them, like, should they go up? And do you think they've still got time, right? Haven't they?
They should go up. I just have no idea about this manager. And I know that he hasn't got a UEFA Pro license. So if they do get promoted, they'll have to do what Gerrard and Lampard did and do a fast track version in order to be able to manage in the Premier League, technically. My best friend's sister-in-law is Georgian, so I've asked her to give me a report on Dynamo Tbilisi and how good they are. So when I get the report back from Tbilisi, I will let you
know. Thank you so much.
Well, Max, you must have got the skinny off Deeney this morning. What did
you exactly.
say?
Well, he said that because there was a lot made that he was dropped.
That was the drama of the weekend.
The story that he said this morning on the radio was that he found out he was dropped on Friday and he was a bit annoyed about it because he wants to play. He got a message to see the manager when he was having a massage. So he messaged back going, I'll be down in 10 minutes. finish his massage. He went down. The manager wasn't in his office. He went to the canteen. The manager was in the canteen. They sort of looked at each other and nodded at each other. So Troy thought, okay, well, it's not a big question. It could be a question about anything. So I'll just have my lunch. And then he sat on the bench and didn't come on. And then thought, okay, well, I'll sort of have this out with the gaffer on Monday. And then the gaffer got sacked on Saturday. And so I guess he doesn't need to have it out with him because he's not there anymore. And that was pretty much what Troy said. But he said he didn't really have a problem with him. You know, he said he was quite a sort of standoffish manager. You know, he was, and managers can be like that, but he didn't believe there was a sort of a problem there necessarily. But obviously they hear inklings that things aren't going well and a manager might lose his job. But I guess, you know, I did ask him if he fancied the job and he said, why would I take a job that I'm going to get sacked from in 5 months? You know, so he's carrying on playing. Right, that'll do for today. We'll be back tomorrow. And then we're doing a Christmas special, Barry, for Christmas Eve.
That's the one where we're all drunk. So that's the only thing special
Me,
about it.
Me, you, Lars and Wilson. The instructions I had to believe are to have half a bottle of wine. And then we'll begin just answering any questions or anything that it might be really short. You may get no questions. So, you know, just 20 minutes of us talking even more shit than we normally are. But look, we'll be back tomorrow with a Europod. But Johnny, thanks for your time. Have a nice Christmas.
Thanks, you too.
Same to you, Flo. Thank you. Happy Christmas.
Thanks, Max. Happy Christmas to you.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
And very nice to know that now it is not legal for you to come around to my house for Christmas Day. Would you like to come around to my house for Christmas Day?
I would love to, but I'm not allowed.
Oh, what a pity. Thanks so much. We'll be back on Tuesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.